The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. So welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. Today's guest is the Australian Ambassador for Cyber Affairs, and I'm really excited to have Dr. Tobias Feakin on the podcast. We are going to walk through a bit of his background, what that actually means to be an ambassador for cyber affairs. It's if it's got the word cyber in it, and probably isn't less than a decade old. And we're going to have a look at what he actually does on the international realm, what Australia's position is, and certainly because this podcast, predominant listeners come from the European Union, focus on some of the areas where there are linkages between the two, and maybe if we can even increase those. So, Dr. Tobias Feakin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Nick. Thanks for having me. Real pleasure and to have a conversation with you around, I think, one of the most interesting areas in government as it currently stands.
Yeah, absolutely. Most interesting, fast-moving, scary, everything all combined.
Yeah, intertwined. Some of the most amazing opportunities that we'll ever know, but also, yeah, obviously some huge pitfalls potentially if we don't address some of the security risks involved in this area. So, yeah, fascinating area to be working in. And I think especially in the current context of technology being so front and center of geopolitics as it currently stands.
Well, I think you'll get along well on this podcast because it's kind of a Buddhist mentality. there's yin and yang with everything.
Got it.
To start things off, as always, instead of delving straight into policy, we want to understand a bit about, the person behind policy, the person behind academia, the person behind tech, because I guess that is the unifying trait amongst all of us individuals walking on this planet. So give us a bit of a background. How did you come to be where you are?
How far back do you want to go? I guess.
How old are you?
probably older than I admit now. Actually, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things is for me personally, and maybe for a listener, is how quickly time evolves when you're looking at the technology space. So yeah. I remember as a very young undergraduate looking at non-lethal technologies, and in and amongst those were cyber effects. Looking at the way in which the US government was trying to deliver certain cyber effects during the first Gulf War. So looking at research back to the early 90s and before, and then trying to pull that together and understand how that actually relates to the modern world and how you can pull new technologies into processes, policy, doctrine, strategy. So PhD in international relations in security, looking predominantly at security and non-lethal technologies, of which cyber was one. And really, it was a kind of a choice that was taken out of massive interest in this new evolving area as a social scientist. And really, it's kind of benefited me all the way along through my career, which has been in think tanks after academia. Spent just over 10 years in various think tanks, the most recent of which was at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, where I took a distinct interest and established an international cyber policy center there and really focused on what was going on in the Asia Pacific. How were different countries maturing their approach to both the beneficial sides of cyberspace, but also the security approach to securing cyberspace? And from those regional assessments, it seemed to marry up very well with the way that the Australian government was starting to put more and more impetus into its international outreach on these issues. And I was incredibly fortunate to be chosen to be the inaugural Australian Ambassador for Cyber Affairs. So it's been a kind of long history of getting here, but I think it stems out of picking a subject that I was deeply interested in and felt kind of incredibly exhilarating at the time, and has led to exhilarating and fascinating turns in my career so far. So I think if there are any advice for a listener out there, make sure you do something that you are deeply fascinated and invigorated by in order that, you know, you can kind of drive your career forward. But sure. As I say, I think in the introductory comments, that's the fascinating thing. Now I find myself again at another evolutionary part of what we're doing in the kind of international community on cyber and tech issues. And you know, when I started this job 2.5 years ago, whilst I was obviously looking at these issues as a core area of strategic interest and the Australian government was making it so, now it is inescapable, the way in which cyberspace and various other technology areas are real centerpieces of international conversation.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a bit more with the international cyber engagement strategy, which is something that that I imagine you would have had a big part in forming. But just before getting into that, I mean, you know, part of the appeal is some information for university graduates to listen to people in very senior positions across an array of different areas within security. And I've had guests in places of security to do with cyber, including a director for immunology and pathogens, looking at who's advised 6 presidents on how to combat, you know, 70s stockpiles of Soviet Union anthrax and smallpox. So, you know, trying to convey, you know, which path you can take is a big portion of this. So I have a question. How was the transition after being, you know, a PhD student, which is kind of, and then moving into a think tank, which is kind of like an extended form of a PhD in some senses, but then the transition to government? I mean, what are the pros, cons? How do you feel with the new position?
Amazing. Look, I'm happy to give anything that's helpful. I mean, interesting when you say you've spoken to people who are dealing with the bio threat. I used to work during my PhD days with an entire set of biologists who were looking at the Biological Weapons Convention. So I feel very comfortable working around those that are looking at weird and wonderful areas of national security analysis. It feels like a comfort blanket when I hear things like that, because it's well, obviously not the issues, but the people, because I kind of understand, you know, the issues and what they were driving at. I mean, deeply unsettling, the issues that they actually deal with.
But
in terms of pathways to take, I mean, that's such a difficult kind of, there's no single fixed solution. I think that's what could I offer someone who's, you know, studying hard and getting towards the end of a PhD. What I do remember was making that decision of, was academia for me? Mm-hmm. And certainly I got the sense that I was not the person who was going to be best placed being in an academic department, writing lots of books and, you know, taking a very rigorous academic approach to my career. I certainly felt that thirst and need to be close to policy and the center of the government discussion. So for me, actually going to a think tank and applying a certain amount of your PhD skills into that environment, and then being, if you like, given a whole new set of skills, which were around, well, how do you convert that academic approach into something which is very policy relevant, but also helps fit you into the business discussion as well around the various areas that you look at. And what I really enjoyed about that conversion was working out that I actually flourished in the middle of so many different sets of opinions and interests. And I found it fascinating how you applied very, you know, those rigorous academic skills into that environment.
Yeah.
And I found for me, that was probably one of the best, most almost vertical learning progressions that I went through, which was making your research very relevant to those that were dealing with the issues in a government level. And, you know, having worked around those in government, I see how fast they have to run at times. And
yeah,
it's very difficult for them to stop, think, and consider the broader, if you like, strategic consequences of everything that's going on. And so the joy of being at a think tank is you do have that space, you do have that time to consult with a whole range of different groups and individuals around you and tackle issues that may be ahead of the curve in a policy cycle. And that's where the real sweet spot in a think tank comes from. So I thoroughly enjoyed that. So then you take that set of skills and bring them into government. I think in a position like BITS, it's been hugely beneficial, because one thing we know about cybersecurity, about cyberspace, when you're dealing with opportunities and risks, well, fundamentally, it's not government that owns all of that environment at all. You know, a majority of this exists with various non-government organizations, with private sector organizations, infrastructure organizations, and a whole range of different stakeholders. So if you like, those skills of convening and consultation, listening, and then applying that into strategy was incredibly beneficial to me in this role.
Yeah,
And certainly the way that it's been established is to embody more than just a government position. The idea being is that this position can stand up and say, this is a truly multi-stakeholder position, which consults as broadly and widely as possible, not just within government, but with broader civil society and the private sector as well.
Yeah.
So in many ways, it's an incredibly good job for applying those skills, whilst also learning new sets of various ways that government process works and how you relate your work to other parts of the bureaucracy, what kind of processes are in place there that you have to make sure you work with to make sure that everyone's on board with things that you're doing, and then how do you feed those up processes. I've also been through another transition, which is also taking those skills, morphing them and maturing them with those skills that all my government colleagues have had for donkey's years doing the jobs they do. So, you know, really interesting change. And I mean, one of the most amazing things about sitting in government is that when you're in a job like this and government is backing the agenda, what you're doing and your team are doing, governments can change things quite considerably. And I think that's something that is incredible to be part of and a real privilege, and something I'll really take away from this work, you know, where whenever it is that I go on to do whatever it is next. But it's an invaluable experience. So I could certainly say to any graduate who's sitting listening to this, I think find the subject that you love and the areas that you think will drive you for quite a long part of your career. And marry those up to the kinds of skills and interactions that you enjoy having. And also don't be scared of taking risk. Don't be scared of taking a risk in life.
Absolutely.
You know, when there are good opportunities around you, grab them. I know it's sometimes hard because there's all those considerations that we have in life, but grasping the opportunity and running with it, you know, it's something easily said, difficult to deliver on at times in our lives.
Well said. I'm sold. Put me in this succession plan. Sounds perfect. Like a pretty good job.
Job done.
Now, if we skip back to what you said about dealing with multiple stakeholders, now this is really a fascinating evolution of and continuing evolution of how government needs to conduct itself across multiple layers of society in different ways, which may or may not have been formerly much more closed off to other areas of society. And the good segue to shift into the cyber engagement strategy. And after we have a pick at some of these points, then we'll jump on to some of the more controversial subjects like, you know, the encryption debate and the Australia's encryption laws, etc. But first things first, cyber engagement strategy. Now, we've got a federal government, state governments, and then local councils, but let's focus on the federal. You're looking at a cyber engagement strategy. So tell us first, I'll do a nice nuanced question. First, your engagement is with other cyber affairs ambassadors if the country or if the nation state has a cyber affairs ambassador, and if not, who do you engage with? Does it depend on the size of the country? And then the second question is slightly more broad. And I'll put in the show notes the International Cyber Engagement Strategy links, which are on the Department of Foreign Affairs. So the breakdown of what the engagement encompasses, which is digital trade, cybercrime, international security, et cetera, and we'll go into that after we get a sense of the first question. And how the government actually works nowadays with private sector. And the private sector obviously plays a massive part in technology. It wields a huge in terms of cyber security, encryption technologies, etc. So muddle that together into a question that works for you, because it wasn't really a question.
Okay.
It was somewhere in between.
See if I can split it into a few component parts. Let me actually start with the strategy, because then I think it will take us into then who should I engage with and who do I engage with?
Sounds good.
And how do we go about our business? So really the first order of play for this job was to develop an international cyber engagement strategy. So the job itself, this position is a whole of government Australian lead on international cyber engagement. So it was to bring together all the different departments in Australian government to say, well, what do we do? What do we want to do? What do we aspire to be in cyberspace? And how do we put that into meaningful strategy, which has deliverable outcomes and ways in which we can understand, transparent ways in which we can express what we've done along that journey. So, you outlined it in your question at the beginning. It's a very broad reaching mandate. We essentially place what we want to achieve in cyberspace around the broader economy. So what is it that we want to benefit financially from the online space? We want to have good trade agreements, which include all sorts of digital trade principles in there. We also want to be able to promote Australian firms delivering cybersecurity products, services, consultancy, whatever it might be, in cyberspace and with other governments and other private sector entities. So how do we promote all of those things in the right way, which is still on, if you like, have the principles of open, free, secure that Australia maintains. Then what are the ways that we can unravel that benefit in particular? Well, one of them is if we don't address cybersecurity risks around our region and beyond, then we could stand to lose ourselves. You're only as strong as your weakest link. So we have a focus on how we can uplift cybersecurity amongst our partners and regional neighbors. Obviously, we all understand, I think, more broadly than we ever did before, that cybercrime is a serious issue. So what are the ways in which we can combat cybercrime internationally? What are some of the methodologies? What are some of the support programs we can put in place to do that? I had the task of shutting down cybercrime safe havens around our region, which was difficult to define and grapple with, but we did, and we came up with, reasoned way of trying to improve capacity in our partners to drive at cybercrime problems.
And sorry, just for the listeners, if we pull the thread on cybercrime, this constitutes much more than just say a ransomware. This is potentially the mechanism to relay messages amongst human trafficking groups across borders and all other manner of crime. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can kind of divide it up into cyber-enabled crime, which gives it that, those threat actors that really allow themselves to do what they want to do and achieve their goals via the use of cyberspace. And then there's very specific cybercrime, and you probably get into more the realms of financial crimes and direct online targeting, ransomwares and the like.
Sure.
That would be taking place there. And so what were some of the issues that we identified is that, in the Asia Pacific, we all know the facts that economically it's still going through significant growth swells. But alongside those opportunities, any criminal sees that as an enormous business opportunity. And then when you look at the fact that many of our regional partners are still grappling with what cybercrime legislation would look like, how you against that legislation, how you have judicial systems in place that understand the severity of those crimes, alongside police services that are still working out the digital forensics piece of how you investigate a crime and then present that evidence in an admissible state into a court, then you have, this blend of an enabling environment for cyber criminals to both physically act from within certain geographic locations, but also to use those increasing bandwidths in our region to facilitate their operations as well. So it's, it's quite a broad mandate. And we work on that side with our federal police and our attorney general's team in terms of trying to uplift our partners' ability to respond to kinds of crimes.
Yeah.
The next part, which is in many respects the part which takes up an enormous amount of time for myself, my team, and also in terms of the agenda, looking at international security issues that we're dealing with in cyberspace. How are states operating in cyberspace? Where are they rubbing up against each other, where are some states perhaps overstepping what is acceptable in cyberspace in terms of the actions that they take, and trying to contribute to how we create more stability in our cyberspace environment.
Yeah.
And that's quite a talk. It takes us into the realms of, you know, the big attack vectors that we've seen over the last 2.5 years, be it a WannaCry incident, be it a NotPetya incident, where you have these global patterns of either malware, ransomware, whatever it might be, having a physical impact on infrastructures, on people's lives, in a way which has led ourselves and the broader international community to say, actually, that's not acceptable. And we have made certain agreements through UN bodies to say that these things are unacceptable. Therefore, we need to expose this kind of behavior and attribute it to a certain actor, and also talk about that activity so everyone can actually defend themselves from what's going on.
Yeah.
So that takes up an enormous amount of the discussion.
Yeah, and that's quite an interesting one as well, because there are some cases where, from a philosophical perspective, because there are some cases where there's a clear cut, that's an absolute no-go. But there's other cases where if you look at the cultural subjectivity of the view of the action, there may be some grayness there. I'll give you an example. One of our big neighbors to the north, which is considered one of the prime threats globally, is the intertwining nature of their government targeted intelligence activities. Now, if we're going to be realistic and pragmatic, any country worth their salt has an intelligence agency. So the idea is to get into the other's network. That's just how it works. And vice versa. Been living in Italy too long. But the other portion of that is there's a no-go if you look at the United States, Australia, etc., where said government agency may commit an act of intellectual theft, because that's considered not a part of the state agenda. Whereas other cultures may consider that just a part and parcel of advancing the country's agenda. Now, if you're a true pragmatist, can you argue against that? Now, personally, I believe I can, but if I'm going to consider that cultural that cultural nuance and that cultural vision, well, it's difficult not to see that there's a big stance that they have. I mean, surely those kind of conversations come up in think tanks and in your position. And also, by the way, think tanks coming from a West perspective are always going to differ slightly in their ability to be 100% objective, because let's face it, that's almost an impossible task, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, on the kind of cyber-enabled IP theft issue, I mean, you rightly pointed out, and this was something that the Australian government did as well with China, was to make an agreement that neither country would commit to undertake cyber-enabled intellectual property theft on either of them. Now, that agreement's been signed through the G20. The US has this agreement. UK does as well. And therefore, I mean, with everything that you said, that may be the case, but those agreements were signed, if you like, in good faith.
Fair enough,
for good reason. So, you know, that's something that clearly we feel is out of bounds, and I think fills that gray space that you so accurately pointed out at the beginning of what you were talking about there. Because our concern is this, if you like, the discussion has become somewhat stunted or stalled at everything beneath the level of armed conflict. And what we currently have ongoing just beginning now in New York and Geneva are UN processes which are essentially starting to try and address everything beneath the level of armed conflict so that we have less gray space.
Yeah.
So that there is a bit more definition around it, because otherwise you do provide this environment where there are things that are kind of questionable and marginal as to whether it's okay to conduct that kind of activity.
Yeah.
And it's not that we're saying that cyberspace is something significantly different from the physical world in the way that it, you know, you can apply the law online as you do offline, but it's, if you like, the parameters are still being set. And I mean, many people have drawn that, if you like, the relationship between the way we're dealing with cyberspace and the way that we're dealing with, you know, the law of the sea. Obviously, we don't have 200 years, to be frank, to create similar kinds of, if you like, precedents.
Legal precedents. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't have 200 years because, to be frank, the technology environment is moving so quickly now. The pressure is on us as diplomats to reach agreement. Now, we feel and we put into our international engagement strategy, we're one of the few countries that's put it into policy, that we've put into the into our policies what we perceive our definitions of or how we interpret law beneath the level of armed conflict. I mean, it's not in its entirety, but we certainly try to be transparent with that. Mm. We've also put into policy that we agree with the 11 norms of behavior that were agreed through the 2015 United Nations Group of Government Experts. And we've put those into print. Now, we didn't formulate all of those ourselves as Australia, and it, certainly not all of those were formulated by our allies and closest friends. But that's part of a negotiation to ensure that everyone could.
So,
I guess our concern is that certain countries choose to turn a blind eye to those arrangements that we put in place and continue to stretch the boundaries. So we think a bit more definition around that beneath the level of armed conflict legal zone is important for us as an international community, so that we don't reach a point of miscalculation, misinterpretation that spirals us into something more dangerous. And that sounds all a bit fatalistic, but
It's absolutely relevant. When there's no, if there's a carrot and stick approach or applying or signing an agreement which is again and again trodden upon, or having an accepted norm, which is the general consensus says this is the accepted norm, and then that again being trodden upon, what's the next step? Because you take that, let's say for an aggressor like Russia, do you take it to the next step where it becomes an actual, a full-blown cyber conflict and then moving to armed conflict? I really appreciated, and I think it was a very smart move for the Dutch authorities, this is some time ago, to basically do a name and shame of the OPSEC of some of the, I think there were four Russian operatives who came into, they came into...
OPCW.
There you go.
OPCW, chemical, yeah.
And I think that's a really, really smart move. It's saying, okay, we obviously don't want full out, full blown war. That's not good for anyone, but we do need to pull these guys back, and we do need to publicly show that, because otherwise the vote's in their favor, because publicly they can say, hey, we didn't do it. From my opinion, that's a great move.
Yeah, and that's certainly where we're heading as an international community, because it's the idea that you can name and shame by yourself as a nation, but actually, Australia was there with the Netherlands in reinforcing that position.
Yeah.
And what we've decided as an international community is that there's obviously strength in numbers. So if we, as a broader set of countries, decide that an attribution is worthwhile and the evidence base is there, then it's worthwhile making these cases together. So, we've got increasingly now a whole range of attributions which involve, anywhere from, 4 to around 20 different countries all on board in making these statements and attributing these kinds of activities. The incident you were talking about, which is when Russian operatives were conducting activities against the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, we felt as a nation that was important to show our solidarity with the Dutch approach. And I think also the fact that it reveals the methodologies as well is important, because that again puts more transparency into open environment. So something we do as the Australian government is we try and share threat signatures as much as we possibly can when we have them with the public, with the private sector, through our computer emergency response team networks to ensure that others can be protected. When we see something egregious happen on our networks, we want to share that so that as many people as possible can be protected. So, important processes for governments to be undertaking. And you also mentioned that, there are question marks now around, well, what next after you've named and shamed? Are there other things that should be done? Mm. Well, certainly, the US has led in the way that it's looked at indictments, prosecutions of individuals, of sanctions. But increasingly, you know, there are other countries. You know, the EU has just approved its cyber diplomacy toolkit, which can be applied as response measures. And I think it's, you know, we as a government have been through a process here in Australia of looking across the suite of tools and levers that you have and thinking, well, what could you apply in response to a cyber incident?
Yeah,
because the likelihood is you don't really want to be responding via cyber means. You want to be applying pressure across the breadth of government responses that you could take.
Yeah, and I think it's a tough one, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, you know, the Dutch supported by Australian action of naming and shaming. It's naming and shaming, and the effectiveness is because it's shoddy OPSEC. That was the true thing. Whereas if you're indicting, and you know, I believe you're referring to the indictment of a number of military officers who were sitting in an office in Moscow, or the military officer sitting in one of the apartment blocks in I can't remember whether it's Beijing or Shanghai. That's almost a badge of honor. And there, you know, therein lies a very different outcome, which is those guys are never going to get arrested unless they're ridiculously stupid and they end up vacationing and, you know, taken in a black bag from Thailand or the Maldives, which has happened before with, you know, a number of cyber criminals. But I think if these guys are government operatives, they'll be, you know, they might have a few more enforced travel restrictions. But it's tough. It's really, yeah. How do you respond? And certainly the last thing you want to do is turn zeros and ones into a gun, because then it becomes really serious. So we do need to move on, because there's plenty of, so I could sit here talking for hours, but I imagine you don't have that much time. So if we sort of scroll down, and for the listeners, I mean, again, I'll put the link here, but you know, having to Toby, shall I call you Dr. Tobias? Or
Toby's good. Just Toby's call me Toby. Good. It's fine.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, yeah. Having Toby on is fantastic, because I, you know, as an Australian expat living in Europe, I can really convey, where my nation's coming from as far as our cybersecurity strategy is, and any engagement obviously we may have with the European Union, which we obviously have very strong ties with. So if we scroll down, and certainly an area of interest of mine, and my background having lived in a number of emerging markets, Guatemala, Bangladesh, Cambodia, familiar with the human rights and democracy issues that can play out in certain states where governance may be there but not enforced. You know, that's a topic for another discussion. But let's focus on what Australia's doing in, say, internet governance cooperation, so maintaining an open, free and secure internet, and then also maybe intertwine that or skip over to human rights and democracy and what we do there and what type of projects we support and through which mechanisms. So is that through DFAT or what used to be called AusAid, which is now not AusAid, it's just part of DFAT? How does that all work?
Firstly, I think one of the really good things to hear is that you've seen a kind of, you grappled with a strategy which is meant to have something in it for everyone. And certainly the way that we work with project partners, I mean, you asked me about how we work with the private sector. Well, we work extensively with various private sector partners. And what they've done is they've looked at this strategy and said, hey, we've got a distinct interest in these areas. And when we've managed to marry, if you like, the national expression of interest here in this strategy with their interest, we've gone on to do quite a lot of project work together and building capacity in various ways. So, you know, the various things perhaps we could talk about, but if we have time during this chat. But I mean, certainly in terms of internet governance, I mean, it's a kind of a strange way that the internet infrastructure has been put together and the various governing bodies that look after it. It's, if you like, a bit of a hodgepodge in the way that it's put together, and very much and why we use this term multi-stakeholder in many respects is, if you like, tipping its hat to the way that the internet architecture that we know and love has been brought together through, as I say, various NGOs, private sector entities, governments, and it's a real smorgasbord, if you like. But what we do understand in terms of internet governance issues right now, and to massively oversimplify, but I think it helps with anyone listening, is that, you know, the way the internet has been run and governed for, you know, most of its existence is certainly under severe pressure. And there are distinct interests from certain states to, if you like, recreate the internet architecture in a way that it's governed, which interprets state, very strong state interest. And if you like, begin to erode that multi-stakeholderism that really has brought us to where we are and the benefits that we enjoy of the internet now. And so one of our jobs, we feel, is to vet through the various different bodies, whatever they might be, ICANN, through the International Telecommunications Union and various other bodies, how can we ensure that, you know, those help uphold the principles and the values of the internet as we know and love it, to ensure that it keeps allowing, if you like, this free flow of data, ideas, principles, innovation, in a way that doesn't become hindered by perceived or and then enacted ideas of borders in cyberspace, which change the way in which we can operate in cyberspace. And some would say maybe, you know, to a degree with some architectures, the way certain countries have built their architectures, you have to a degree already got that. But I mean, I'd argue still we're not at the stage where we've got a completely fragmented internet architecture. I think there's still a lot to protect and value in this idea of, you know, free flow communications, ideas, etc.
Yeah.
So that's something that, you know, we work hard across the various different international bodies, regional bodies, to ensure that we keep advocating for that multi-stakeholder approach, which is not easy. It's tough at times, but we think that's something that's vital to keep pushing forward on. And one of those key issues that we think is important for to exude those principles, we have to talk about human rights online and democracy online, and the fact that human rights apply equally online as they do offline. So, you know, we do advocate heavily for human rights principles through whether it be the Human Rights Council and through the various other multinational groupings that we work with to try and ensure that, there is, principles of freedom of expression and association and communication are upheld in an online environment. And it's, again, not always a very easy discussion because there are very different interpretations of human rights depending on where you go in the world.
Certainly. And even the fact that, you know, human rights itself, I mean, it's actually a beautiful and yet 100% necessary fiction. Do we even have human rights? There's actually a great philosopher called Yuval Noah, someone who wrote the book Sapiens. And it's an absolutely necessary framework so that we function as a society, local society, broader global society. And yet, there's obviously going to be very different versions of human rights because at the end of the day, it is a fiction. It is a construct. But anyway.
I mean, fascinating to get into these concepts. You know, so often in my life is dealing with various different aspects of different meetings and bureaucratic process, but it's important that you don't lose sight of some of the core principles, ideals, and strategic interests that you have in an environment like this, which is so all-encompassing. And how do you go about like ensuring that human rights are defended in an online environment? And I mean, often it's very difficult for governments to be the sole conduit for that. So certainly one of the ways which we do that is by supporting various different areas of work, which are very much non-government led, which we think assist in promoting, highlighting human rights issues in various parts of the internet. So we're very clearly part of the Freedom Online Coalition and also help work with and support the Digital Defenders Partnership. And, you know, that emerged in 2012 from the Freedom Online conference in 2012. And it basically provides grants to support defenders of human rights online.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think bodies like that, they do things which are quite edgy in comparison to maybe what a government could do. And so, you know, we look at various ways that we can, unconventional ways that we can support those kinds of activities.
The listeners out there, the Freedom Online Coalition, I was actually at a big annual event last year in Berlin, and it was, you know, the quality of speaker, the integrity of participant is really second to none. There's that attracts some amazing people from around the world, you know, human rights activists and internet activists from different countries in Africa where it's very dangerous to be in that position. So no, it's good to hear that Australia is fully behind that. Okay, now I do want to jump to technology for development. There's a body that I'm quite familiar with, which is OzCyber. Now, I don't know the current CEO, but I'm in touch with the former CEO, Craig. So for the European listeners out here, I'm a panelist on the European Cybersecurity Organization, which is the contractual counterpart to the European Commission. So it's the public-private partnership for, effectively, it's to develop and enhance a cybersecurity services and product ecosystem in Europe, and then, you know, build investment opportunities within and without. So I guess akin to what OzCyber's concept is, and perhaps Data61 as a form of CSIRO, maybe in some other senses. Now, speaking honestly about this, and I've spoken openly about this with the director for cyber in the European Union, European Commission. This is a tough one because you're trying to develop a marketplace and there are a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of money that's being thrown around, which traditionally has well-worn and well-worn train tracks where the VCs know exactly how to spin and how to work their magic with a particular product or a particular set of people, and trying to replicate or maybe simulate a market in a similar sense takes a lot of time and it isn't easy. And now I'll get into more specifics. Been to Tel Aviv and enjoyed the hospitality there and had a look at the different mechanisms that they have in order to build this centrifugal force of amazing tech coming out. And it's not just hyperbole. There is some really, really advanced technical process and know-how and product that comes out of that. And yet that's one country with very, very vastly different geopolitical background and a construct where they just have, you know, VC, military, intel, private sector, academia, all melded into this one sort of melting pot where they can actually, you know, pump out a market which punches way above its weight in terms of, you know, the size of the country and the population. I know that Australia, federal and state governments, in fact, I was there a number of years ago in New South Wales when we received an Israeli delegation, and we've been sort of trying to take notes. All this is a big preamble to ask the question, how effective is this development of a market ecosystem to be outwardly facing and attractive for foreign interest and purchasing and investment in our cybersecurity product and services sector?
So, I mean, got a lot in what you just said there. I would say, firstly, this kind of fits more into our kind of trade promotion agenda.
Okay.
And so certainly something we do look at is how have other ecosystems established themselves? What is it that we can learn from them? How can we play into those market environments? You mentioned OzCyber, their CEO, Michelle Price. She's been going great guns at ensuring that our Australian companies are present and making hay in various different market environments. OzTrade, the Australian trade grouping, has done a grand job as well of giving a whole range of landing pads around the world in key market environments so that Australian companies can, or small startups can base themselves in particular market environments. You know, no surprises. It would be, you know, Tel Aviv, London, Silicon Valley and the like, Singapore as well, in order that they can get a flavor of what that market environment's like, learn from it, and hopefully launch their products into that market.
Yeah.
As an Australian industry, I think we're in a very different place to even 3 years ago. I think with the uptick in interest from government, from broader venture capital, you've seen a number of companies begin to do really well in the global environment. I mean, I just think of the figures. You know, we've sent groupings to the RSA conference in San Francisco now for 3 years in a row. And I think the first year we maybe had about 12 companies go with us, and this year we took just shy of 50. So, you know, you can see there's a broader interest of both personal investment, but also contracts that are coming to Australian companies. You know, if we had the exact magic ingredient, I think we'd have had it by now. I think it's that blend of market availability, venture capital funding, you know, government support where needed, but also ensuring that government doesn't get in the way too much to ensure that innovation can get into the marketplace as quickly as possible. And also, you know, the right amount of promotion into the international environment too. In terms of the kind of broader technology for development agenda that we've been running, that's very much looking at, well, how do you use technology to improve the development situations of other countries? So, and it really plays across the entirety of the rest of the work we do. So just in terms of the sheer numbers, we invested as a government $4 million for this kind of capacity building work. When I first started this role, we're now investing about $48 million in capacity building around the region.
Yeah.
And that is targeted at a whole range of different activities, be it cybersecurity, technical uplift, policy uplift, awareness and access to the discussions on international law and norms, incident response management processes we assist various governments with. We also try and ensure that various startup communities are able to contribute to various development issues. We just launched a whole 4 different projects in Solomon Islands, which were aimed at uplifting the education sector. So availability of actual education spaces and skills, and then also trying to match those with applications into the market environment, into getting better job access through digital platforms. So there's kind of a whole array of work that we support there. And that includes a hell of a lot of work with various big private sector entities and smaller SMEs as well.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's also been uplifted by the fact that Australia has made bold decisions around investing in undersea cabling, and really, you know, trying to deliver the backbone of internet architecture, especially for our Pacific partners.
Yep.
And so then, you know, providing, if you like, the cybersecurity risk overlay on top of that and assisting countries in understanding, whilst there are huge opportunities which will drive out and assist you drive out, there's also these set of risks that come alongside increased bandwidths without, you know, proper risk management process. So, you know, we've done a huge amount of work around the Pacific on that front.
Okay.
So it's a fascinating area of work, and one which is, I think, vital. You know, if we have a better, broader international ecosystem on these issues for both the benefit and, you know, the corresponding security responses, then, you know, that benefits Australia in the long term.
Sure. And also, you know, within that region, of course, I mean, I spent several years living in Cambodia and working all throughout Asia Pacific. So there is a bit of a tug of war and posturing and implementation and competition in, as far as who's developing the infrastructure, because that kind of gives them a lot of say in process, strategy, et cetera. So we'll see how that one pans out over the next decade. So we'll get into the final portion, because I know that you've been very generous with your time. Well, look, we've spoken about a lot of the benefits and the positives that the government's doing, and of course there are massive areas where we're investing and working for positive good. Now, for some of the contention, I watched it was actually a really good YouTube discussion with you, Alistair McGibbon, Lev Grossman, and Katina Michael. And I've got to say, Katina, I'd never heard of her before, but she's her ability to articulate and put her stance across was really, really. I was very impressed. Now, for the listeners, it was, and you can check it out on YouTube, it's a Discussion versus FDA case. Now, it's kind of the David and Goliath, it's like the Goliath and Goliath showdown between, say, a tech company, which may or may not be posturing for, well, either because they have a heart, as Lev Grossman suggests the CEO may or may not have, or not, or whether it's a reality, whether they truly actually believe the doctrine that they spurt forth, which adds to their share price. I think both sides have a lot of merit, and I think both sides also have a lot of, come with a lot of hyperbole. Would you mind just quickly breaking down what the argument is? Because I think this sort of, it really directly impacts many other countries in the periphery. And certainly, I mean, we're, you know, with the United States being one of the Five Eyes countries, it certainly impacts us. And then from this argument, if we can jump to our position on Huawei and how we are akin to the US, but how United Kingdom has been up until, I think, quite recently, and I spoke with Kieran Martin about this on the podcast with him, opposed to an allied Five Eyes state. So again, with my ridiculous meandering questions, are you able to package an answer?
Sure. So the event that you were referencing, I'll just need to put into context, was before I was in this role.
Okay.
So it was still when I was in a think tank, but still interesting how a lot of those kind of discussions are still very relevant to us today. I think let me just kind of break down a couple of the key issues as they stand. I think one of them is around the kind of continuing discussion around encryption and the ability for certain parts of our security apparatus to have access to encrypted encrypted data. There's certainly been a way in which firms have built communications devices in a way which makes any kind of access nigh on impossible. And I mean more from the responsibility side. Essentially, for encryption, you're looking for an encryption key to decrypt the information. And basically, we've got to a stage where most companies now have thrown away those keys. And again, I'm massively oversimplifying. Sorry to your listeners if they're cursing at me right now.
That's all right.
Doing a disservice to
you. Can't win them all.
But essentially, companies have thrown away the responsibility, any responsibility they may have to be able to decrypt anything in their devices. And I think it's more like the best way of posing this is a question for society, which is, well, do you think that's okay? Do you think it's okay that you wouldn't be able to have access to potentially, security situation changing information because you can't actually access a specific piece of data? And I think the other issue to kind of break down, if you like, is like the ethical principle. And I think we have a lot of ethical principles we need to work through as a tech community now around all sorts of new and evolving technologies. And that will include 5G, which is the conversation that you're alluding to. So I mean, on the ethics side, it was the idea that, well, is it okay for a large company to not allow access to a specific device, but then maybe have different principles when they're dealing in a different market environment where they might be different in their ethical stance? And I can't go any further than that, being a government representative, but I think you can pick a part in the way you wish for that. And I think, where does the broader issue come here, which is we have a range of multinational firms now who are enormous tech giants and, produce the most wonderful products for all of us. But there are now question marks because I think consumers have become far more data aware and far more aware of what the transactions might be in their interactions in an online environment. And also as governments, the pressure equally comes to governments to then consider their citizens' rights, privacy, and also their ability to exert the law in the online environment too.
Yeah.
So there are so many different complex variables coming at this issue that often I fear, and even before I came into this job, I always feared it becomes so overly simplified depending on where you sit. The media will paint a picture in one particular way. Companies might, paint it in another. And it's just so complex what we're dealing with here that it requires complex solutions. So
absolutely. I think what was stated and what you've seen recently is a coming out of the shadows at least enough so that, not so much that you're not sacrificing the strategy, but enough so that you're engaging. Because I think what really irks, even people from, say an Australian populace, the reason why there's hysteria, which is amplified by media, is because it seems hypocritical when you do have documents exposed by people like Snowden saying, well, this shit was happening anyway on Cisco's or Juniper. you know, certain vendors, which of course the aim of the intel agencies is to identify what's happening in the adversary. So I think, you know, if my two cents, and I think what you see in the market as well, is just with a sheer engagement and saying, you know, potentially posing the question, well, we don't want to obviously show our hand too much because that's strategically poor play. But to get the public engagement and the public support behind it, we need to actually say, look, you know, fair play. This is what we're doing, to as much as we can talk about, as opposed to hiding behind 100% shroud of secrecy, because then you're shooting yourself in the foot.
So look, I think you hit right at the end there on an absolute key differentiator in this discussion. I think if any of your listeners are nerdy enough, and I hope they are, I'm a massive nerd and I would, go and have a look at how much information we publish as a government, whether it be on our use of offensive cyber capability. You know, our head of Australian Signals Directorate has been incredibly transparent on the front foot in talking about the parameters of offensive cyber use.
And that was a great example that he did, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, also about our vulnerability disclosure policy. You know, that's there on the ASD website.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and look at that. It's transparency. We've spoken about and published in the international engagement strategy our approaches to international law. You know, we have so much information out there. You can also go and delve into all the different deliverables that we have in our international engagement strategy. There's 61 of them, which is an enormous amount. And you can see what we've been doing and how well we've been tracking. Like, it's transparency. And, you know, if there's anything I think we've learned as governments is be transparent. This is an issue. Yes, of course, some of it will always rest in the secret realms of, you know, government structures deep in the basement.
Yeah.
But most of this now we need to be talking about, we need to be transparent with, because in that way you get the broader swell of public and business support in order that you can really deal with this issue in the way it needs to be dealt with, which is a whole of society approach. And that sounds like an easy thing to say, and yet how do you deliver on it? But it's genuinely that, you know, this is an issue like very few do, which affects someone at home by themselves operating on a computer, all the way up to grand strategy of geopolitical consequence of countries rubbing up against each other, you know. And there are very few issues which touch the entire spectrum of people, organizations, and places. And this one does. And I think the only way that we get better at these sorts of things is by being more transparent, more communicative with the public, and being better around technology and cyber issues more broadly. You know, so, you know, yes, the Australian government did publish a view on 5G vendors and principles around which our security risk analysis was based. And I think you'll probably see the world continue to look at ways in which they look at new emerging technologies, and especially in the digital environment, and thinking about risks in a different way than they perhaps did in the past.
That's a really good example. Sorry to interject, but I think, you know, there was one paper which was published by, it was a Spark telecom in New Zealand, where there was proven separation of edge and core. And yet that's, from my mind, that's possibly not thinking about it with a everything connected mentality, because sure, you might have that separation, but still you have an influence when everything is connected. So it's not looking further enough into the future potentially.
And I think that's the difficult leap for governments right now in this kind of highly contested geopolitical environment.
Yeah,
is the idea that tech decisions that need to be made now and in the next few years are going to affect us for the next 20. And there's going to be a whole range of these issues now which will keep arising, where we need to be thinking creatively and occasionally hard-headedly around, well, what does that look like, and how can we make bold decisions or future leaning decisions, because these technologies will fundamentally underpin our societies for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's not an overstatement. It's very much where we find ourselves. And again, I mean, if we relate this back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, for a position like this, that's, you know, you're in the middle of, if you like, the inflection point of a lot of technologies which seemed like in fantasy land for a long time, are now becoming realities and shapers of people, societies, and countries and businesses. So as governments, we need to work out, and are certainly, you know, making approaches to how we enable these technologies with the right sense of, if you like, security, ethical, human rights, and broader principles around them. And it's not an easy environment for governments to be in, but
no,
it's the environment that is exactly the space we're in right now.
Yeah, and add to that the dichotomy of maybe implementing, you know, a massive sort of core infrastructure, hardware, things that are tangible into your network, and yet with the massively fast-paced development and advancement of software tech and even tech itself, you've kind of got a dichotomous implementation of technology right there. So I imagine your job's really easy, isn't it?
Yeah. Any advice taken on an email to me? Anyway, that's the importance of roles like these within governments, and you know, maybe kind of where you kind of end up in looking at all of these issues that we've had is, well, what are governments doing about it? There is an increasing swell of positions like this, which are within foreign affairs departments, who are engaging in that diplomatic conversation, that strategic conversation with, both states and also big industry tech players, trying to make sure that the environment that we all shape together over the coming years is one that's favorable to as many as possible.
Yeah.
Because there are other influencing powers out there which create a future technology landscape that isn't one that would be as favorable to a lot of your listeners, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I think we can finalize. So Dr. Tobias Fiken, it has been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this chat and hope to continue conversations. Last thing, when are you in Europe? When can we host you in Italy?
That's a good question. It's the million-dollar question is, what's my travel plan? I've actually briefly been through Europe last week, but no doubt I will be there later on in the year. So let's see what can be done with my programming. But Nick, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Really enjoyed it. So thanks very much for reaching out. And look, really, really hope some of your listeners enjoyed that conversation.
Thank you very much too. Cheers for that. Take care.
No problem. Thank you.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.